5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
En Cox, estamos un paso adelante. Como el muchacho que ya sabe la orden de tu cafecito incluso antes de pedirlo.
Hey, José, café con leche sin lactosa, un toque de vainilla templadito sin azúcar.
En Cox también nos adelantamos a lo que necesitas. Por eso el precio de tu plan no subirá por 3 años. Y nuestra seguridad avanzada protegerá tu red de amenazas antes de que pasen. Cox, un paso adelante. José, llamada de tu jefe en 3, 2, 1. Al menos 500 megabits por segundo de velocidad y Cox Unlimited Mobile. Impuestos y cargos no incluidos en garantía de precio. Velocidad de datos móviles reducida tras usar 20 gigas al mes.
Hello and welcome to this special episode of The Lotus Eaters. I'm Harry, today joined by the author Josh Neal, and we're going to be talking about his latest publication with Antelope Hill Publishing, Intolerant Interpretations. Josh Neal is the author of American Extremist and Understanding Conspiracy Theories, and we're very grateful to have him on. Thank you for joining us, Josh. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I'm a big fan of your program. Love what you guys do, and very happy to talk about my new book.
Yes, I'm very happy to talk about it as well. So we were sent this by Antelope Hill, and I took up the opportunity to give it a read. And I've got to say, I was very, very impressed. Just straight away for the audience, if you get the chance to pick this up, and you can pick it up on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, other retailers, you can get it from Antelope Hill's website. Well worth a look, because it is a really interesting piece of sociology and philosophy looking at and critically examining some of the, what I would argue are some of the critical thinkers of our modern global liberal technocracy. And again, it is very, very critical of these. These are thinkers ranging all the way from Karl Popper to Jonathan Haidt to Daniel Kahneman and the sociologist and child psychologist, I believe, Paul Bloom. And let's start off with the first thing. What made you choose these particular authors to critique, particularly somebody like Jonathan Haidt, whose work seems to be quite respected on both sides of the political aisle, and Karl Popper, who I have my own critiques of him, but it's rare to find a lot of really thorough academic scholarly critiques of Karl Popper's work from a right-wing perspective.
Well, with regards to Jonathan Haidt, I first read his book 2014, 2015. Mm. And I won't say it changed my life, but it definitely, I was in between doctoral applications. I was trying to make it as a professional psychologist. I didn't have a research project in mind, which was the major obstacle to pursuing a PhD, at least in the States, for a lot of the programs I was looking at, 2015, 2016, the types of, well, let's put it this way. The woke DEI regime was very much in full swing. So when I was looking at different programs, it was, this is not every university, every research lab, but a lot of them were, you know, a black woman studying microaggressions, a gay person studying the comorbidity of depression and HIV, not to be vulgar or disgusting for your audience. I mean, you scroll through a dozen of those, two dozen of those, and you think, well, maybe there's not really a place for me in this environment. But I read Jonathan Haidt's book, and I had political opinions, but growing up, I was a libertarian some 10 years ago. I didn't, I had major issues with the way that the right and the left, or in the States, Republican and Democrat, were conceptualized. And reading that book, I thought it was interesting because Haidt used a lot of the more rigorous psychological models to make his argument. But at the end, I still had that same problem of there's a conceptual issue. Well, there's two problems. Any good liberal social scientist, no matter how good their analysis or critique is, at the end, their conclusion is always, well, we just need more progressive liberalism. We just need more managerialism. We need more equality. We need more compassion. So that was one issue. But the other issue was, as I said before, this conceptualization problem. Like, what do we really mean when we talk about the Democrats and the Republicans, or the Tories and Labor, or, you know, so on and so forth? That had just been kicking around in my head for the last 10 years. And when I wrote my first book, American Extremist, which was more directly about American political culture, I kind of put down my own foundations of what I think about politics. And it was easier for me to revisit Jonathan Haidt and say, well, you know what? The problem here is that this is a liberal looking at a hegemonic liberal system, and he's not able to step outside of that framework. He's not, for a social scientist, Jonathan Haidt, I think, is one of the good ones. He does a tremendous, there's a lot of things he invokes that are sort of heterodox in the social sciences. He talks about group selection. That's a no-no. He talks about irrationalism, what he calls the social intuition model. And irrationalism, which I sort of have my own issues with, is something you don't talk about positively in the academy, because irrationalism invokes things like Nietzsche. It invokes things like prejudice and bigotry and the 20th century and, you know, mass violence campaigns, which is not true. I mean, you can maybe tease out a genealogical strain here or there, but you can't blanket condemn these philosophical traditions or points of view simply because of what's taboo in the current political climate. So Jonathan Haidt was sort of an outlier. The rest of the people I focus on in the book have a more direct relationship to the ideas of the open society and liberalism, egalitarianism. They have a direct relationship to the conspiracy, the fear-mongering about conspiratorialism. I put Jonathan Haidt in there because I had promised my audience for a long time that I would write a formal essay about it. But because I had also read, the thing that had helped me unpack Jonathan Haidt a little bit was reading James Burnham's The Managerial Revolution. And that sort of unlocked a lot of doors for me. And thinking about the sort of polarization in the United States in terms of political economy and demographics, rather than in terms of strict conventional wisdom about political affiliations. So someone like Karl Popper, it was very easy for me to choose. Richard Hofstadter, very easy for me to choose, because both of these are sort of liberal maximalists. Both of them wrote extensively critiquing conspiratorialism. Richard Hofstadter is obviously most famous for The Paranoid Style in American Politics, an essay he wrote about, you know, Barry Goldwater, Robert Welch and the John Birch Society, obviously Joseph McCarthy and the success of Red Scares in the United States. Karl Popper also wrote an essay called The Conspiracy Theory of Society. Richard Hofstadter in an earlier book wrote The Conspiracy Theory of History. So you have these liberal maximalists. In the case of Richard Hofstadter, actually both of them, Hofstadter and Karl Popper, in their youth were card-carrying communists. Richard Hofstadter was a member of the American Communist Party. Karl Popper was active in communist demonstrations when he was still living in Europe. In both cases, they moved to a liberal moderate, heavily scare quoting that, a liberal moderate position. But they maintained sort of a philosophically unjustifiable prejudice against, you know, what we can call closed societies, or, you know, nativism, conservatism. Richard Hofstadter, also very famous for coining the phrase pseudo-conservatism to malign the types of people that Sam Francis would have called middle American radicals, you know, just normal Americans with a, you know, even a modestly conservative bent, who are economically productive. They respect the civic institutions. They are participating members of society. And bear in mind, at the time that Richard Hofstadter is doing some of his most important writings, the United States is going through this massive transformation. It had just undergone the New Deal. And at the time of the paranoid style in American politics, the United States was beginning a civil rights revolution. And you have just normal Americans all across the country who neither like nor understand the direction that their country is going in. And so these were people who were very easy to select. One, because they're very prestigious members of the recent liberal philosophical tradition. Richard Hofstadter won multiple Pulitzer Prizes. Karl Popper, also very easy to pick. On the one hand, he's been a right-hand punching bag going back to the days of Glenn Beck. But all you have to do is look at someone like George Soros, who named his foundation the Open Society Foundation. And it's not just that he named it the Open Society Foundation. It's actually that Karl Popper mentored many of these prominent liberal maximalists, one or two degrees of separation away from people like George Soros, Richard Hofstadter, Cass Sunstein, who's another sort of antagonist in the book.
He was the author of the book Nudge, wasn't he, Sunstein?
Yes, yeah. He was also the information czar under Barack Obama. And
it is interesting how all of these people connected to Karl Popper, who have this explicit goal of this open society, all default to a form of technocracy, which is increasingly top down.
Mm-hmm. This is what I got out of James Burnham, was that there is something that changed liberalism in the 20th century. James Burnham argues that the Soviets and the NSDAP were sort of developmentally ahead of Great Britain and the United States in the regards of developing this elaborate technocratic managerial regime. And certainly by the time we get FDR, the technocracy is being established. Richard Hofstadter, in his book, Anti-Intellectualism and the American Tradition, talks about the journey that American intellectuals underwent from being sort of alienated from the establishment to suddenly being critical to the establishment, the state administering policies, managing the population, nudging the population. So this also brings in Daniel Kahneman, whose very famous book, Thinking Fast and Slow, he published 10 or 15 years ago. And he was a Nobel Prize winner for his critique of utility theory. But more importantly, he spearheaded this program called the Heuristics and Biases Research Program, which was this massive revolution in the cognitive sciences. Without being unfair to him, sort of the received wisdom of his program is that human cognition kind of sucks. It's unreliable. It relies on these faulty intuitions. And he makes sort of, again, this is one of the trends that I uncovered researching this book, is the extent to which all of these very intelligent, highly credentialed, well-placed intellectuals have a very unintellectually rigorous approach to presenting the ideas that they want the audience to accept.
This was particularly critical with authors like Popper and Hofstadter in the first essay in the book. I noticed the passages that you were quoting from them, particularly as regards to conspiracy theories and labeling people conspiracy theorists. I got some a passage here from Popper from the Open Society and Its Enemies, where he says, conspiracies occur, it must be admitted, but the striking fact which, in spite of their occurrence, disproves the conspiracy theory is that few of these conspiracies are ultimately successful. Conspirators rarely consummate their conspiracy. To which you ask some reasonable questions, which are, what are these conspiracies that never turned out as intended or were never consummated? Why did they turn out as they did? What conspiracies did turn out as intended, were consummated? Why was this so? And you ask a number of other questions because these authors just seem to think that they can get away with stating it as fact without providing any evidence, which ironically for somebody who was a scientist like Popper, you would expect that he would have some kind of empirically rigorous evidence and argumentation to back up his statements, whereas he seems perfectly willing to just throw them out almost ad hominem, which, as we'll get on to later when we discuss the other idea that you introduce in the first essay of the ethno-narratives, seems to be very consistent with this brand of thinker. We just saw, I mean, you mentioned the John Birch Society. I mean, we just saw the other day with Mark Levin's speech, where he was going against Tucker Carlson and Nick Fuentes, bragging about how you know, we've cancelled people before. Screw saying we don't cancel people. We cancelled Pat Buchanan, as if that's something to be proud of. He doesn't mention him, but you mentioned Sam Francis. They all cancelled Sam Francis back in the 1990s. And he goes back and says, we cancelled the John Birch Society as well. And in the essay, you have your own criticisms of the John Birch Society, where they didn't go far enough, how they were still kind of trying to operate within this 1950s, 1960s conservative liberal framework. But that was seen as enough of a threat by some people for the ADL to infiltrate them and to bring that organization down. So these people really don't operate on the basis of argument, evidence, anything that can really be considered within the Western tradition of empirical, self-reflective, introspective, critical thinking. They really operate on the basis of bullying and name-calling and just mafia tactics, operating as a mafia and crowding you out of your own movement.
It's funny, the woke right is calling from inside the house.
Yeah, exactly.
That
blocked
was
by Konstantin Kissin, by the way.
Yeah,
happy to have earned that one.
Oh, congratulations. Well, that's why I titled the book "Intolerant Interpretations." There's a certain hermeneutic, probably butchering the pronunciation of that word, hermeneutic that I'm bringing to this work, and I'm very transparent about this in a way that these fellows aren't. I'm bringing a certain level of skepticism, you could even say hostility, into my reading, sort of like the ace up my sleeve, because I approach it, I read it, and I'm trying to read it as, what is this person saying? Does it have its own merits? But of course, I came to these people, Karl Popper, Richard Hofstadter, so on and so forth, Cass Sunstein, Richard Thaler, Daniel Kahneman, with a suspicion that these people were doing something, like you said, other than science, other than, you know, rigorous, empirical, substantiated philosophical or empirical reasoning. So, I mean, and the punchline at the end of the book is that you need to, just because something is published in a book and it has a notable, prestigious publishing house on the front cover of the book, and the author has a Ivy League degree and you saw him on television or whatever, doesn't mean that the contents of the book are themselves meritorious. It's all of this, to borrow a phrase from Robert Cialdini, who's a famous social psychologist, it's all persuasion. In other words, you are sort of encouraged to accept the contents before you have read the contents, because it's front-loaded with all of this establishment pomp and circumstance. There's credit, and this is sort of what defines technocracy, in a sense, that you have people who are rubber stamped by the state, and you can now turn off your critical faculties and say, well, this is an approved authority figure, and what they are saying is correct. At the very least, what they're saying is something that they've labored intensely over. Even if they're, you know, marginally inaccurate here and there, well, this is a guy or lady who spent his whole life studying this, or her life. So clearly there's merit to this. And, you know, people like Nathan Koffness today, or Tom Nichols, who wrote The Death of Expertise 10 years ago, 12 years ago, as people like them lament, that's gone. People don't believe experts. They don't believe credentialed professionals. And they don't believe them for reasons like you just presented. Karl Popper makes these polemical declarations that he never tries to substantiate. And when you test the polemical declarations logically, they don't even cohere. So there's one section in that excerpt that you quoted from where Karl Popper, this is really funny to me, Karl Popper says that, for example, the reason that, you know, the Germans or the Italians didn't win in the 20th century is because they didn't have a completely accurate social theory to inform their government policy. So in other words, if they were bigger nerds with lab coats and thick rimmed glasses, then they would have won and we would be celebrating them today instead of maligning them.
The amazing thing there being that if anybody knows about the Germans of the mid-1930s is that they actually did have a lot of writing and thought backing up everything that they were doing. Agree with it or not, but like he does understand how, or I mean, he was, wasn't he an Austrian Jew, Karl Popper?
Yes.
So he
yes.
should have a rather firm grasp of how autistic the Germans are with such things. But there's those two things there, which is one, which is the desire to try to reduce everything down to a to a laboratory experiment with very, very controlled variables. And this is something that you discuss with Daniel Kahneman and his nudge theories, and also the research that he did into the way that the brain operates. And he came to the conclusion that the brain has these two differing functions which clash with one another, that you actually contrast with the thoughts and work of, what's his name, Gerenz. Could you pronounce that for me again, please?
I mean, I could be missing it too, but yeah. I say Gigerenzer.
Gerd Gigerenzer, who sees the brain as a much more holistic organ that works together in a way that's able to spot patterns over repeated frequencies, whereas somebody like Kahneman wanted to reduce everything down to single experiments which prove that the brain on those single examples is unable to properly calculate something to the desired result, which actually in a way kind of results in a gotcha. When I was mm-hmm. reading the examples that you were giving of Kahneman, so for instance, he says if a test to detect a disease whose prevalence is 1 in 1,000 has a false positive rate of 5%, what's the chance that a person found to have a false positive result has the disease, assuming you know nothing else about the person's symptoms or signs? And you mention how with that example given, most of the students at Harvard answered wrong. Only 18% of them gave the correct answer. But when, for instance, you word the question differently in a way that goes less to a single example as given there and talks about the frequencies. If it's got 1 out of 1,000 Americans has this disease, every time you do these tests, if you test 1,000 people, 50 of them test positive for the disease, even though they're perfectly healthy. If you've got 1,000 people, how many, if taking this test, who get positives would you expect to actually have positive? And people were much better able to calculate the proper answer there and come to a 76% of the subjects, when it's phrased differently, were able to actually give the correct answer there. So it's kind of this weird thing where Kahneman has formulated a problem in such a way as to kind of act as a gotcha to his own test subjects. You know, and kind of forms the problem in a way that only really exists in those sterile, controlled, perfect lab scenarios. Whereas the environment that we interact with in a day-to-day basis only it is not a sterile lab. We have all of these different variables. We have all of these different patterns that we recognize through frequency, not purely through one-off occurrences. So there's that idea. And then there's also the idea that Popper is presenting, which is that in the same way that the scientist presents himself as purely neutral, the forces of history, so to speak, are purely neutral. There is a one-way travel of direction for the way that history works. So the reason that the Germans and Italians weren't able to succeed during the Second World War was because they just got the conspiracy wrong. That just wasn't the way that history was flowing, which completely ignores all of the other variables. And this is the other thing that Popper and a lot of these other writers take out. And I think this is Haidt's mistake that he makes when he's analyzing, coming to some of his conclusions, which is they completely remove, purposefully or accidentally, the role of top-down power in generating consensus and generating opinion. I mean, Popper, for instance, there's that whole idea of the paradox of tolerance,
right,
which is argued quite often on social media, where there's the one graphic that comes up of, here's what Popper said against the paradox of tolerance. And then there's an opposing one that says, no, it's kind of from like a centrist, center-right perspective. Where they say, no, here's what he actually means with the paradox of tolerance. But then you actually go into the open society, and interestingly enough, for something that's been argued over, it's actually a footnote. It's an endnote at the end of the book. And I went through it, and the whole idea of the paradox of tolerance is you can't tolerate the intolerant, because if you do, they will destroy tolerance, right? Which seems like something that for our current globalist, open society, liberal regime is very useful, because what it allows them to do is just label their enemies as intolerant or as conspiracy theorists who are unwilling to tolerate opposing views to their conspiracies, as we see often through the writers in the book, and then just say, well, you're off limits from discussion. You don't get to participate in society. You don't get to express yourselves freely, because if we do allow you to do that, then you are going to destroy everybody else's opportunity to do so. And people try and argue against this by saying, like, no, if you read it, he doesn't actually mean that. He means this. And they go into a big word salad about why it's actually in favor of centrist free speech. And then you actually read the passage and he's like, no. The government reserves the right to do this to people who are intolerant, which ignores the fact that the government, by being the power center, by having the ability to propagandize and generate consensus, can just label you a priori as intolerant, which cuts you off from discussion entirely. And that's something that a lot of these writers do, which is they are ignoring the top-down position of power in generating consensus. And I think that's where Haidt goes a little bit wrong, because I had, when I read the book, the same problem as you, which is by the end, he kind of defaults to a normal liberal, oh, we just need to keep defending democracy and things will turn out all right. Whereas he's suggesting through the moral foundations that there's something inherently wrong with liberals' brains,
right,
almost, by saying that, oh, they don't have these moral foundations. And it plays into, as you explain, the conservative prejudice to, like, these liberals, they don't think right. But ultimately, no. What they are conformists.
Yep.
They have been fed an ideology top down that they have naturally conformed to, because, as we know, most people will go along to get along. Most people are not natural mavericks who are going to step themselves out of the crowd if they can help it. So it's not that they don't have these moral foundations. It's that those moral foundations have been turned to non-conservative ends.
Yep.
And I think that's where he goes a little bit wrong there. Sorry, I was going on for a little bit.
No, that's fine. There's so many things I want to pick up on. With regards to the paradox of intolerance, I would recommend to you and your audience a book by Daniel Ziblatt and Stephen Levitsky called How Democracies Die, where they basically say that they take this paradox of intolerance and they say, well, that's literally how liberal democracies operate, is that the major hegemonic parties will collude to shut out the radicals. They will collude to marginalize sort of like the genuine, whether it's like Bernie Sanders style economic populism on the left, or, you know, MAGA style populism, Nick Fuentes, whatever style, more nativist right wing populism. These are the groups that are the most intolerant, which is a way of saying they are the most threatening to the paradigm of liberal democracy.
And something else as well, people want to draw these distinctions between popper and like Frankfurt School radicals, for instance, like Mark Hughes. But I fail to see how that's any difference from Mark Hughes's idea of repressive tolerance. It just comes 23 years earlier. These ideas had already been seeded within the government apparatus long, long before Mark Hughes ever wrote his essay for the consumption of university students.
By the way, Richard Hofstadter and Karl Popper were avowed acolytes of the Frankfurt School, which is, you know, so it's like in their free time, they're reading that and it's informing their work. The other thing you said about the social theory, again, I mean, this is maybe more of a heuristic than a golden bullet, but if you're going to make critique, and I'm very conscious of this myself, you have to be careful that the critique can't be turned on yourself if circumstances should change. In other words, if we are taking a Popperian view of fascism, national socialism, what have you, and we say ultimately it was an intellectual failure because they didn't have a rigorous enough social theory, just look at how things turned out. If they thought it out, well, the calamity of the 20th century wouldn't have happened. If we look at today's world, can we really say that the architects of liberal democracy had a coherent, cogent social theory that explained everything all of the time? Clearly they didn't. Maybe your audience is familiar with the replication crisis. That's a problem in the social sciences, in particular psychology, where many landmark studies have been revisited and they found that either the data was falsified or there were discrepancies, inaccuracies, what have you. Many of these landmark studies were studies conducted to present a formal liberal psychology, a formal liberal social theory that you could teach to university students, that you could publish on the nightly news, that you could sell, that you could write best-selling pop psychology books to propagandize the audience into believing things like, oh, the more interactions you have with a foreigner, the more you're going to like them, you know, contact theory, all of these kinds
of things. Experience, I can't agree with that one.
Well, because what's funny to me is that the most hardline, whether we say nationalists, nativists, conservatives, that I've met have all been people like me, people from metropolitan urban areas where every day of your life you're rubbing elbows with someone from Pakistan, someone from Kenya, someone blah, 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 blah. So clearly it doesn't work because the most radical, ideologically opposed people are the people most inculcated in these heavily diverse liberal totalitarian states. So that's kind of funny to me. There's with regards to Jonathan Haidt, and this I'll put a bow on it. They all, like you said, whether knowingly or unknowingly, adopt this bottom up sort of emergent social order theory of social order that things just happen organically, if you want to use it Deleuzian language, rhizomatically, you know, it's all flat, horizontal, non-hierarchical, sporadic, voluntary, sort of impulsive. And that's how power structures emerge, in this sort of spontaneous order, a will of the people, spontaneous order thing. But then you look at someone like Daniel Kahneman, who was an IDF psychologist embedded in the Israeli military. He's revolutionizing the field of psychology in this totally top-down manner as someone who's in one of the most, I guess in the 1960s, we wouldn't say Israel was one of the most powerful countries in the world, but nonetheless, they had a kind of prestige and authority and influence that other nations didn't have. And that's what his system, the heuristics and researches, heuristics and biases program has done is basically taken over the cognitive sciences. There's very few people, prominent publishers in that area, that will dispute the things that he said in terms of this catalog of cognitive errors. Now you go into any university Psychology 101, the cognitive science chapter is just this laundry list of cognitive errors that, as you said before, that Kahneman basically, in a sort of Wittgensteinian language game, created a game, supplemented it with a type of statistical reasoning, basically putting his finger on the scale, and then administering these tests to psychology students who, A, are, you know, they're like 18 years old, they don't know anything. B, they're not technical statisticians, so they're unfamiliar with the language and the methodology being employed. And they are deliberately being manipulated to produce an outcome that will justify what people like Daniel Kahneman or Richard Thaler or Cass Sunstein or any of these people believe, which is that you're a dum-dum. You're a dum-dum, and we need this paternalistic libertarian technocracy to make all of the decisions for you. It's just remarkable.
Yeah, and it is all for the goal, all for the aim of convincing people that in some way they're fundamentally, due to just the way that the brain naturally happens, they're broken. And this is a through line that can actually be traced through the entire work that you've presented here, all the way from Hofstadter and Popper trying to demonize what you deem to be, what you title authentic folk narratives, which is like, because of the complete deluge of information that we have these days in the information age, where it's kind of in a way designed to be non-understandable for the average person, people do come up with some crazy sounding ideas. But then also a lot of the crazy sounding ideas, when you look into the evidence of them, I'm thinking Pizzagate, for instance, seem to have a lot of evidence, or at the very least, lots and lots of converging circumstantial evidence that points in a particular direction, completely demonizing those kinds of narratives, which the mainstream media, if they were actually living up to their journalistic standards, should look into, should investigate, should uncover if there is something there, and instead just top down branding them all conspiracy theorists. And you do get people, as you know, in here, like latter-day Alex Jones, who play into that caricature and stereotype a little bit too well. Either way, those are normal ways of perceiving the world, given the information that you have access to and given the way that the brain functions through recognizing patterns and seeing the frequencies of particular things and starting to paint a picture from them. Then you've got Jonathan Haidt. And I don't think Jonathan Haidt is malicious in doing this. I think of the authors that you're critiquing here, Jonathan Haidt does not seem to be doing this on purpose. It might just be his liberal priors and his kind of semi-conversion to conservatism that motivated this unknowingly. But he kind of stigmatizes liberals as not being morally complete, you could say. And then Daniel Kahneman comes through saying, well, actually, if you look at it the way that I've studied it, the brain doesn't work at all, really. This thing that's been keeping us alive and was evolved to like help us to navigate our environment doesn't work at all. And it creates all of these problems and errors according to my standards, which aren't the standards of the real world, but I'm a scientist. Therefore, I'm the priest class, you listen to me. And then you go to the final essay where you're examining the work of Paul Bloom and his studies on child psychology and the origins of evil, which seems to be him just trying to find a way to prevent armies of what he sees to be baby Hitler from rising up all over the world. Anywhere in Europe, there's a baby Hitler right now, so we need to beat into him that he has to be the exact opposite of that. He has to be a gay race communist, or else, you know, things will be bad for the Jews again. Is this through line just saying, you're broken, you're broken, you're broken, you need us looking after you? And it does have real world effects. I mean, from my own generation and my own experience, it especially has effects on women. You talk about Paul Bloom, how he almost gloatingly talks about how when bombarded with all of this anti-white guilt from a very young age, people experience a great deal of personal anxiety just trying to navigate all of the different rules that you could call woke, people trying to be woke and stick to all of the ever-changing rules of being woke, they end up just in this permanent state of anxiety. And I know people who've been like that from a very young age. I was raised in this environment. I was raised under these narratives. And when people have that permanent state of anxiety, when they're told from everywhere, your brain doesn't really work properly, you're broken, they do revert to following what authority tells them to do. They make it very easy for something like the COVID lockdowns to push onto them this idea of like, oh, the science knows best, do what the science tells you. And the darkest part of that is the doctors pushing medication on these people. Like loads of people that I know, because they think their brains don't work, because they have this kind of social anxiety that comes with all of the problems of modernity, the first thing that happens, they speak to a doctor, they get put straight onto medication, which doesn't actually help them. It just makes them a client of the technocratic regime we live under right now.
Yeah, there's a lot there. It's just funny to me when you were talking about Richard Hofstadter, one of the sort of black marks in his legacy is the extent to which, now, unlike Karl Popper, Hofstadter did name specific conspiracies. And in the two instances that I'm familiar with, both he was proven wrong. in the Paranoid Style in American Politics, and I quote it, so you probably remember this passage, he talks about vaccinations. He says, you know, even if he does a sort of Jacques Lacan thing. Lacan was a famous French structuralist and a psychoanalyst. And the sort of line that everybody knows from Jacques Lacan is, if you are jealous, or if you are worried that your wife is cheating on you, and she is cheating on you, it's still pathological that you had the skepticism about her. That's sort of like a Lacanian syllogism. And Hofstadter uses this, does a version of this. He says, even if it's proven that the government forcibly and covertly mandated vaccination. No, I'm sorry. He did fluoride in the water. That was the example.
Yeah, yeah. Because I was thinking it reminded me of the character from Dr. Strangelove, the Kubrick film. And it's like they're destroying our virility with chemicals in the water. But that's kind of part of this, which is it's showing these characters as a point of mockery. But carry on.
Yeah, it's one of the oldest media punching bags. Even if it's proven that the federal government is secretly administering fluoride in the water supply to bring about a socialist government, you would still be an irrational, paranoid crank to think that, to worry about it. And obviously, many decades later, we know that that has happened. It's ongoing. Some years ago, the Massachusetts governor she's like, we need to put more fluoridation into the water because of XYZ political goal. And the other example he gave, and I don't quite remember this exactly, it was from The Age of Reform, another Pulitzer Prize winning book of his, where he basically, The Age of Reform is basically looking at the transition from the Gilded Age in the United States to the progressive era of the 20th century. And one of the arguments he's presenting is that the sort of the political concerns of the agrarian, if you want to say Jeffersonian style population, the old style populists, didn't gain traction until progressives almost a century later had taken them up, sort of disenfranchised, maybe petite bourgeois in places like Chicago and New York and elsewhere, who are also feeling the burn from money power, from industrialization, from the replacement of their era. Which I would long for a great replacement of the 1830s, where it was just other Irish and other Germans and other so on and so forth. He does this sort of caricature of the populist paranoia around money power. And then obviously there was a study some 10 years ago, I cite it in the book, where a guy went back and like forensically recreated you know, follow the money, figured out, you know, exactly how he was wrong. So he's using all these instances to sort of lambast and mock the conspiratorially minded people. And the most famous examples he's used have been proven to be correct in the opposite direction. And this is part of the reason I wrote this and the last book, Understanding Conspiracy Theories, is I wanted to support the conspiratorially minded and give intellectual ammunition to the cause. Because in my view, and this is maybe a very America-centric view, to be right wing or even to be American is to be kind of a conspiratorially minded person. The United States were founded in a climate of great power conflict. They were founded with covert organizations like Freemasonry and so on and so forth. The very first third parties, the very first third party in the United States, which was in that Gilded Age era. So we're not even 100 years after the signing of the Declaration or the Constitution. And they were anti-papist, anti-Freemason, anti-mass migration, the American People's Party, the Know-Nothings. These were sort of interregnum parties between the Whigs and the Republicans. And they were concerned with the same types of things that we're concerned with today. These are fundamental civic questions. Who has control over the money? Who has control over the government? Who are we as a people? These are fundamental existential political questions. And we can say conspiratorial if we want. I would just say they're existential questions. And what is any conspiracy theorist primarily concerned with? They're concerned with existential questions. There is a malicious power out there who specifically wants to hurt me, or specifically wants to hurt my community, or my way of life, or my religion, or so on and so forth. So these are deeply existential questions. The polemic against conspiracy theorizing is a polemic against you and me engaging in existential discourse. Who are we? What are we? How do we have influence? How do we provide for our children? And how do we, I'm trying not to get too spicy here. How do we make sure that our way of life persists? You know, which is what every group of people all over around the world have ever wanted to do, have ever consumed themselves with, is we want to keep living. We want to be who we are and we want to keep living. So there's more things you said. I don't want to take up too much time. I'll kick it back to you.
No, that's all right. On the point that you were talking about there with Hofstadter, to begin with, where it's just like, well, yeah, you could say that all of this stuff is happening maybe with the fluoridation of the water. And even if it's right, then you're still wrong for thinking at it. That kind of polemic is at the heart of all of this, which is even if you're right, you're wrong. In one way or another, you can't win because you are not at the levers of power. But this only further encourages people to question, well, then if I'm not at the levers of power, if I can't do anything right, even if I'm factually correct, well, why is that? Who is it that's determining that I'm wrong? By whose standards am I wrong? And that's where the spicy part of this whole thing does come in. That's where the question of is all of the work that you're critiquing here malicious or not comes in, because I think it's difficult not to acknowledge that every author that you're critiquing in this book is Jewish. And we just have to be upfront about that. And that's not to label all Jews as being in on some large conspiracy, but these particular liberal, open society types do seem to be, Paul Bloom especially, you point out how he doesn't seem to be able to go through a single page of his book on child psychology and the origins of evil without invoking the baby Hitler fallacy, without invoking that we need to find some way of preventing the next Holocaust. We need to, everything that he's doing is being heavily, heavily influenced by his experience as an American Jew in the post-war era. You mentioned that Kahneman was an IDF Israeli, like he worked for the IDF. So there is that question of whether or not this represents all people, and I don't think that it does. We can both reference people like Paul Gottfried, who I think that we would both agree has done some amazing work. Like when you talk about pathologizing people, Paul Gottfried has been one of the best at pushing back against that in his books like After Liberalism and Multiculturalism in the Politics of Guilt. Because a lot of what you're discussing here is kind of presaged by his work discussing how people have been through the technocracy, through the post-liberal order that we live in right now, pushed into this sense of feeling guilty for who they are. You're a broken person. You need to let me, the elite technocrat, mend your brain. But still, a lot of these people do seem to be motivated by their sense of their own Jewishness. And that's where you mentioned the idea of ethno-narratives. And that's where this whole idea of the intolerant interpretation comes from, is recognizing that. I don't think you can say that it's wrong for people to recognize all of that in these people's work, to recognize where somebody like Karl Popper is coming from, given his historical background, to recognize, we mentioned the Frankfurt School. The Frankfurt School, Theodore Adorno, his work, his massive, massive work, The Authoritarian Personality, frankly, seems to me to be a pure attack on the idea of the stable Western nuclear family that does seem to be influenced by his experiences as somebody who was attacked by the German regime of the 1930s. Karl Popper is going all the way back to Plato to try and libel, because that's frankly what it is. We've discussed how his arguments are completely specious. He's not actually making arguments. He's just saying, he's just libeling these people. He's libeling the foundations of Western philosophy. So there is something to these people do seem to want to tear down a Western sensibility, a Western sense of selfhood, by weaponizing our own conscience against us so that they can implement their own rule by technocracy. And that's that whole intolerant interpretation. There's nothing wrong with recognizing all of that, reading it, and allowing yourself to be on guard against such a thing. While also, of course, to be very clear, recognizing this is not representative of everybody, nor even necessarily a majority or even significant minority, but these people are all in powerful positions. Their word has had much more influence, sadly, than the work of somebody like Paul Gottfried.
Paul Gottfried, who was mentored by Herbert Marcuse of the Frankfurt School.
Thank you for reminding me of that. Yeah, he came to very different conclusions.
Yeah, I mean, and I referenced Paul Gottfried extensively, especially in that Jonathan Haidt essay. There are very few. Paul Gottfried almost has like an Anglo sensibility in terms of sort of like plain-spoken objectivity. Like, that's one of the reasons I like Paul Gottfried's work so much, is that he has a really excellent ability to cut through fluff and BS and just say, well, this is what was really happening. This is what really X represents X and so on and so forth. But with regards to Paul Bloom, and we're getting down to the bottom of the hour here, so maybe I'll make my final pitch and just try to put all these themes together. You get the sense reading Paul Bloom, and again, maybe Paul Bloom sort of seems like sort of an outlier in this, but I would remind your audience that Paul Bloom is like one or two steps removed from the dissident right, effectively. He does a lot of events with like Red Scare affiliated people. He's like one degree of separation from our milieu. He's one of these maybe more based, more moderate social scientists, because he has certain niche views on other taboo subjects. But you read his book and you get the impression that he must have spent all night binge watching The Boys from Brazil if he was so concerned about like knocking on the door and there was, little Adolf there. the things that are remarkable about the book, and you invoke this idea of an ethno-narrative, not my original conception, that comes from Jean-Francois Lyotard, who in his book, The Postmodern Condition, talks about the collapse of grand meta-narratives. And other people who've taken up this idea, like Stephen, I think his name is Stephen Hicks, who's like a very Jordan Peterson tier.
Oh, yeah, he wrote the that anti-postmodernist book, didn't he? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so he's one of the more prominent critics of postmodernity and postmodern thinking. But they take on this idea of the collapse of grand meta-narratives. That never really sat well with me. It wasn't like people spontaneously stopped believing in Christianity or Britannia or, you know, America or whatever. It wasn't like we just woke up and said, oh, these things are outdated and we have TV now and microwave dinners, so who needs it? It was and because I don't believe that, I sort of also don't believe in this idea of nihilism, that there's this epidemic of people who just don't care about anything and they don't see meaning anywhere. What they specifically are experiencing is alienation. What they're specifically feeling is a disconnection from their own tradition and their own way of life and their own historical, you know, continuity, their ancestors, so on and so forth. So it's a very particular malady, which is the result of the what I call the conflict of ethno-meta-narratives, which is basically a way of saying different groups have mythologized themselves in a particular way. And when they come into conflict, there's not just physical conflict, particularly in our day and age. It's cultural conflict, intellectual. You are making contact with other countries, you know, popular cultures, media markets, so on and so forth. First contact for a lot of us is through media. You know, before I ever met a Japanese person, there was Dragon Ball Z on my Saturday morning cartoon.
Same right here.
So, you know, before I ever met a British person, you know, I watched the Amadeus movie as a kid, or a German person, I guess. There are a lot of English actors in that movie, but obviously it's set in Germany.
All the best actors are English.
All the best everything is English. All the best countries are English. America, England. So not that I can claim a whole lot of English ancestry, but anyway. this collapse of ethno-meta or confrontation between ethno-meta narratives, and that's sort of how I view someone like Richard Hofstadter, and in the sense that you have Richard Hofstadter, your audience can fact check me here. Go to Wikipedia. The very first two or three sentences will say that Richard Hofstadter, and I'm paraphrasing, was effectively the figurehead of the post-war liberal consensus. So if James Lindsay is watching this and he's saying the post-war consensus doesn't exist, that's a fantasy. Go to Wikipedia. Richard Hofstadter is literally the one academic most connected with this consensus school of history. And what is he doing? Richard Hofstadter was very prolific. He wrote about the entire American experience even to when it was just colonies, even to the 17th century, before the Declaration, before the Constitution, before the Revolutionary War, before the Constitutional Convention. He's writing all the way up until his death, which I think was the 1970s or 1980s. And he's representing American history to, at that time, a still predominantly Anglophile culture and elite. And he's representing it, even though he's disavowed his communist views, he's retained the ethnic core of those communist views, and he's representing American history through that lens, and that becomes the dominant way in which Americans see themselves. To such a degree, you can skip reading Richard Hofstadter if you really don't want to. You can just go back on YouTube and find old episodes of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Then every night, Jon Stewart is effectively parroting condensed soundbite versions of the Richard Hofstadter worldview. So why is there this epidemic in the United States and in many other parts of the world? It's because you have this clash of ethno-narratives. Paul Bloom, just to bring it to to the close here, Paul Bloom is doing a sort of ethno-scientific, ethno-narrative approach to developmental psychology. And we know this because, as you said, all but one of the references he makes in the book, speaking to human cruelty, injustice, violence, things like that, are all historical examples from his experience and his people's experience. And you also mentioned before that, you know, he quotes a study. These are how you know these people aren't really interested in actual scientific knowledge. He quotes a study, I think, conducted in one of the Scandinavian countries, showing that white people experienced intense anxiety when asked to think racially, to make racial judgments. That is, to me, that would be such a landmark finding, that you've got one population on the planet that experiences extreme stress when they're asked to engage in a very simplistic type of cognitive process. No other group does that. Only white people do that. And there's no interrogation of it. Why is it this way? Why should it be this way? Shouldn't we be offering interventions to help these people? There's no questioning at all. And the punchline of his book is ultimately we need more of that kind of behavior. So you take one step back and you have to ask, what is the purpose of this? Why is he doing this? What message is trying to be conveyed? What is this person's attitude about the scientific literature in general? Is the attitude, well, all of this needs to work for my pet interests? All of this needs to be made coherent with my specific ideological commitments? Because if that's what it is, that's not science. That's an ethno-narrative. And I sort of, in a few instances throughout the book, I expand what I consider to be an ethno-narrative to include other things that maybe your audience will take issue with. Things like communism, I view as sort of an ethno-narrative. And maybe to give a little insight, if anyone in your audience is going to read this book after watching this, maybe read it with this in mind. Part of the reason I disagreed with Jonathan Haidt and went and wrote a whole essay about it was because I didn't like the way in which commonplace terms and concepts are being deployed so frivolously and liberally. Today's world, everything is communist. I don't live in New York anymore, but I'm from New York, and they just had a mayoral election. Zoran Mabdani won. And the sort of mainstream right is freaking out that he's a communist. It's like that ended a long time ago. Zoran Mabdani is not a Trotskyist. He's not a Leninist. He's not a Maoist. He doesn't have a poster of
Stalin
or Brezhnev in his study somewhere. He's in many ways actually a completely assimilated progressive liberal millennial, but he's a communist. Okay, that's going to lead to problems in a few ways. Understanding Mamdani and how he got elected, resisting Mamdani over the course of his administration, right? That's why I use this phrase meta-narrative or ethno-meta-narrative, because ultimately, I mean, if you look at what Lenin did in Russia immediately following the revolution, there were some very liberal socializing tendencies. You know, it's almost in some ways kind of indistinct or indistinguishable from what has transpired here. I guess option A would be we call all of this communism. My solution would be is we look at the specific people and groups of people behind these actions, what is important to them, and work from there. In a sense, what I'm trying to do, I'm a sort of materialist in the sense that I try not to ascribe to ideology what can be understood by primal things, like, to borrow a phrase from a friend of mine, faith, family, and folk. who you belong to, things that you don't get a choice in, things that inform your everyday waking choices and actions. And I'm hoping that this phrase catches on, because I think if we start deploying language like an ethno-meta-narrative as opposed to ideological language, we can actually understand what's happening and we can actually organize, whether we're organizing against it or simply organizing ourselves to achieve our own style of life. It doesn't necessarily have to be like a political conflict or any other kind of conflict. I'm an American. I believe in things like freedom of association. I think, you know, we should be able to have our own thing. And so, you know, there's always two options, right? You can go and attack the Mamdanis, or you can create a, you know, anti-Mamdani space somewhere else. Maybe there's a third option. I don't know. I'm ranting a little bit, but yeah, that's what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to end it. If we just say that, I think one of my my best takeaway from all of this is that when all of the institutions and when all of the power centers, from the very moment that you're born all the way to your death, are trying to tell you that you are broken, that your brain doesn't function properly, that your foundations of morality are all wrong, and that you are evil from the moment that you're born, unless you are propagandized and unless that you are controlled top down and nudged every waking moment of your life. When that is a world order that is purposefully designed to make white people, people of European descent, to be in a constant state of anguish and anxiety, that one of the greatest acts of resistance that you can take is to recognize that you are not a broken person, to take a positive message from all of this, which is that your brain works fine. You don't always need the medication. You don't need to listen to these narratives that tell you that you're a terrible person just because of the fact that your ancestors were more successful than everybody else's ancestors, that your ancestors came up with the greatest works of philosophy, the greatest works of fiction, the greatest pieces of music ever. That's something that you should be proud of. That's something that you can be proud of and that you can learn yourself. And I do think that people are starting to try and break through and break free of these ethno-meta narratives. You can see just from, we mentioned him at the beginning of this, Nick Fuentes being somebody who has suddenly got a lot of mainstream push with the interview with Tucker Carlson. People can take Fuentes however they want personally. I think that ultimately him and his message becoming more mainstream and spreading out there is a sign of one very, very positive thing, which is that among a significant portion of young white people, not just men, but young white women too, they are starting to break free of this. And I think ultimately that people will, on a personal level, just feel so much better in themselves if they recognize who they are, they recognize their traditions, they recognize their faith, without that anxiety, without that being forced on them, without their nose being rubbed into the dirt. So that's one of my best takeaways, which is the people who spread these narratives were not your friends. They wanted to weaponize your feelings of empathy and guilt against you. And it's time that we start breaking away from that. And I think we really are starting to see a mass of people starting to break away from that. So hopefully we can all take a positive message from that. So it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, Josh. And for everybody watching, please pick up a copy of Intolerant Interpretations. It's a really, really excellent book. We've not discussed the whole thing. We've only touched on a surface level. There's some really fantastic analysis and writing in here. I'd really recommend it. Where can people find you, Josh?
Well, first off, let me say thank you so much for the invitation. It was a pleasure. You can find my first two books at imperiumpress.org, but they're also available on any other book publishing site. The new book is available through antelopehillpublishing.com. You can also find it anywhere else. I do regular video and essay content on my blog, jneil.substack.com. And I'm also on X, Still J. Neil, STILLJ Neil. That's where you can find me.
Well, there you go. So please give Josh a follow. It's well worth it. Pick up his books. And again, Josh, thank you very, very much for joining us. And to everybody who's watched this interview, thank you for joining us. Take care.